Welcome, dear seekers of health, happiness, and harmonious cosmic humming, to another installment of Season 2 of the Pebble in the Cosmic Pond podcast. I am Sabina Wilms, owner of Happy Goat Productions, in collaboration with Leo Locke, self-proclaimed purveyor of multiple perspectives. As always, we're here to bring you old and new stories about China's healing traditions and about medicine with a capital M in heaven and on earth, and in that creative and tender sweet spot in between. For our Season 2 on Over the Moon, we interview second-generation immigrant Asian women practitioners in the West and their take on medicine and on female health in particular. As a combination of their professional training, embodied traditional knowledge from their maternal lineages, and personal experience. In today's episode on olives and porridge, Leo and I are talking to Kara Conroy Lau. Kara is a beautiful global border-crossing practitioner of Chinese medicine and Buddhism who has ended up in Canada near the Clear Sky Meditation Center in Cranbrook, after growing up in Singapore, New Zealand, and Japan. I loved our conversation for how it revealed Kara's courage and humility and deep dedication to her healing work, both within herself and in her community and family. Here are some of the questions that Kara shared some pearls of wisdom about, which I believe are relevant not just to those of our listeners who happen to be female, of Asian descent, or medical practitioners. How do we tease apart the individual strands that make us who we are today? Or in other words, how do we recover the precious ingredients that went into the melting pot before modern life took the stick blender to it? How do we heal the cultural ruptures and broken transmissions to link us back to our maternal lineages and to recover what Kara calls knowledge that is in our bones? How do we overcome decades of internalized racism and attempted assimilation to the dominant white culture to share something, in Kara's case, as simple as hot water and goji berries on a first date with a fellow Asian woman? Inspired by Kara's life history, our conversation ranged across multiple fertile intersecting identities between being white and non-white, colonizer and colonized, male and female, straight and queer, Chinese and non-Chinese. When I asked her at the very end to reflect on the influence of her maternal Asian heritage on her current practice of Chinese medicine, her answer was as simple and profound and powerful as her healing work, from what I can tell. To find out this answer and what all this has to do with olives and porridge, I guess you'll have to listen to the podcast. So let's get into it. Here we go. Leo said we're ready to hit the record button, and Kara said, in the mood for love. We're rolling. We've got it recording. We're doing another podcast on healing and love and presence and somehow figuring out the intersection, I feel like, between healing as, I don't know. Leo, what are we trying to do here? My guests today are Leo Locke and Kara Conroy Lau. I hope I said that right. And we can talk about your name in a minute because I thought that was really interesting. And we are trying, Leo and I are having conversations with people who are healers in the bigger sense of that word. And we're trying, I think what I'm interested in is how what you, our interviewees and our listeners, what you're learning, what has been transmitted to you in your clinical education, in your training to become a healer, and how that is being fed, nourished, multiplied, potentized, embodied by our interviewees as women and people of Asian descent. So it's like this tripod where what you have learned in your clinical institutional training and what you are doing in your practice is sort of the platform that the rest of the world gets to sit on. And I feel like maybe that tripod is supported by, on the one hand, your clinical training. On the other hand, what you have learned from your mothers, your aunties, your grandparents, your grandmothers, and then of course the guys too. Leo, we got it. That's a whole other. At some point, we have to switch and interview guys and see how that. But for right now, we are playing with this maternal thing. So we're playing with what you received from the mothers, from the maternal figures in your life, and then the Asian knowledge that is not. That is not spelled out, the non-rational thing. Am I making any sense at all here? Leo, is that a fair description?
I think so. I think, and this is a great time when we can have Kara speak about her heritage. And, you know, so because I don't know much about Kara either, so I'm very curious about her heritage. If you can speak a little bit on that, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Thanks, Sabina. Thanks, Leo. Right. Well, you know, I feel like I'm probably, if you want to head towards the men in future, I'm kind of like a middle ground, you know, because I'm kind of, well, I'm queer. I don't feel my connection with the female side of my family has been very strong for a long time. And that's changing and that's changed, changing. And also, I feel like in terms of ethnicity, I really am a thorough product of the British Empire in that my father is New Zealand Irish immigrants and my mother is Teochew Chinese immigrants to Singapore. That's her family, right? So I feel incredibly mixed up. And I also grew up in different countries. I grew up in New Zealand and Singapore and partly in China and in Japan. So I really feel like I am an example or a sample of global melting pot. Yeah. So anyway, if I have anything to share on that, I can bring anything, sure, but I don't.
Well,
I think maybe
we're interested in the sweet spot. That's mm-hmm. what we're interested in, right? We're not, right, Leo? That's exactly like this bridge, that's I think that's where that transformation, that's where the room for growth and transformation comes in.
Yeah, and I think over the years, you know, thinking about these things, I grew up very in a quite a white culture in New Zealand. And I remember I used to walk in front of my mother on the street because I was embarrassed. Right? She's from Singapore. She has quite a strong Singaporean accent. You know, she says H, and I'd say, no, it's H. I don't even, you know what I mean? And and I would try to look as white as I possibly could, right? And so anyway, that's one aspect of my upbringing. And then I had to learn, then over the years, I was in an international school in Japan, and I remember one of my Japanese friends, she was in an international, she said to me, "Oh my God, you speak Chinese, you're half Chinese? That is so cool." Her name was Yukiko. And I was like, "What? Are you serious? Really?" Because I'd having moved back from Singapore, went to New Zealand when I was about 8, I tried to get rid of my Singapore accent as quickly as I could, right? When I moved back to New Zealand and become a Kiwi kid, which is the accent you're kind of hearing right now. And I'm visiting New Zealand right now, so it's been very good for me to see the conditioning all laid in, you know, here. Anyway, so, you know, this Japanese friend said, "Wow, that's so cool that you can speak Chinese or your mum's Chinese." And I'd never heard that. I'd never had that affirmation, really. I was about 13 or 14 at the time. So when I went back to New Zealand at 14, 15, I, you know, did Chinese classes again and then really got into the China thing, you know. Chinese at university, did my undergrad in Chinese, human geography, and then went in that whole Han Yu Qiao. I was in the first Han Yu Qiao speech competition that mainland China put on for foreigners to compete in Mandarin. I was a New Zealand delegate. I was really bad, but anyway, that's all right. So then I became super, you know, into all the communist history and Mao, and like, you know, I had a blue jacket and a green hat and a bag with a star on it, you know, that whole kind of thing, you know, Red Wild Swans, all those books, you know. Anyway, and then I was so into China, and as soon as I finished university in New Zealand, I just wanted to go to China as quickly as possible and leave, you know. And I kind of left New Zealand at 21, and I haven't really been back. I've been back for a couple of visits, and here I am right now for a longer visit, but I really started to embrace the Asian side of my heritage. But it was in a kind of more intellectual, on a more intellectual level. And then I went to Chinese medicine school in my later 20s, right? So I went to Chinese medicine school in Canada. After having met Dharma, Buddhism, in Japan in my early 20s and studying in that, in a particular lineage that has roots in Canada, actually, the Namjo lineage, I started studying in that lineage in Japan and then came to Canada to help out at the meditation center, Clear Sky in BC. And then later was like, okay, I need a bit more of a career. So I went back to school for Chinese medicine. So that was a whole nother embracing of my Chineseness. But I think through that whole process has been wonderful. But then it was like, oh, but what about my relationship with my mother and my grandmother? And it turns out my mother's grandfather was a Chinese doctor. And no one had even, I'd never heard that. I'd never heard it till I'd already opened my clinic in Cranbrook and my uncle said, "Oh, by the way, my grandfather was, you know, our grandfather was a Chinese doctor from China." You know? So there's these whole things we don't learn about our families and I think we are, what is it, does it mean to be Chinese now anyway? What is it, you know? I really am really curious about that question because my Chinese family, side of my family, what is global, what is colonial, what is British Commonwealth, what is Teochew, what is mainland Chinese, what is, you know, it's all very, very interesting, isn't it? So I can't say what in me is Chinese or what have I learned from my family and what have I learned through education, what have I learned through Chinese medicine. It's all a big mix, isn't it? And I didn't know that all the whole story around
and
the
And here
the
goes
kind of,
Sabina.
Yeah.
Like, go ahead. Like naively saying, "We want to hear about this box and this box and this box and this tripod." And what you're saying is, "I'm just sitting on a giant big beanbag."
Yeah.
You know what? Tiny little pieces.
When I was thinking of talking with you guys, the song that came into my head was, you know that song, "The Great Big Melting Pot"? What we need is a great big melting pot. Big enough to fit the world and all it's got and stir it for 100 years or more. Do you know that song? It's from England, I think, from the 90s. Mm. And so I feel like the world...
My daughter did a really cool paper in, I think, in high school. And she... And my daughter is American, but has a German... She's a little bit like you, I think. She would really relate to this. And she rejected the idea of the melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
she did not like the image as an ideal, that it should be ideal. And, you know, Leo, you've talked about this. And I think in a way what we are trying to figure out, we want to honor, we don't want the big pot of soup where you put a mechanical stick blender in and you turn it all into, we want the chunks of each, we want the visible pieces, yes, of ginger, yeah, and garlic, and
you need to get to know your ingredients very, very well before you make a soup. I had to go back and really figure out who I am and where I've come from. And then to now realize, well, who I am and where I've come from has all these individual, very unique strands. And it's been affected by the last however many 100,000 years of history, which is different peoples affecting each other, learning from each other, affecting each other's economies, structures, families. You know, there's been a lot that's gone on, especially in the last 300 to 500 years, right, on the planet, in terms of everybody mixing,
yeah,
and getting thrown into this pot, whether we like it or not, right? I was thinking about... go ahead.
Oh, I'm just curious, like, about food. When you were growing up... with your mom being Singaporean tier two, how was it like? Did she cook you a lot of Chinese food?
Yeah.
How was
I was like good food. I hear now from Chinese restaurant owners in Calgary, they're like, your tier two are really good cooks. I'm like, really? I didn't know that. No, the food was really, my mom's cooking's very good. You know, steamed fish with ginger and black sauce chicken, and we'd have the Singaporean chicken curries, and, you know, just really good, healthy food. And my mum cooked basically all the meals. So, yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting, Sabina. We never talked about the tier two people in our conversation so far, right? Because we never met one until Kara showed up. Because the tier twos are a very interesting clan or group from southern China. Have you heard of them, Sabina?
Actually, no. So
yeah, in Mandarin, it will be called Chao Zhou or Chao Shan. The Teochew is an endonym. The Teochew people call themselves because Chao Zhou is pronounced Teochew in Teochew, right? And they're a very influential a group of people because Singapore has a lot of tier two people. So does Bangkok.
Mm.
So a lot of the billionaires in Southeast Asia are of tier two descent. So they're number one, they're famous for their food. Second, or number one, they're famous for their business acumen and networks. They're because they're so coastal. So they're basically a Minnanese-speaking people that's located in Guangdong province, right? So, but they're very maritime, very international, very hardworking, and very smart in terms of business building. That's why a lot of the Southeast Asian nations, a lot of the commerce are dominated by the Teochew people. Singapore is one example. Because I grew up across the border from Singapore, and that region is very... most of our food are Teochew, like rice noodles. When you see rice noodles in Bangkok or rice noodle in soup in Singapore and Malaysia, that is of Teochew heritage. Yeah, so that's something fun to talk about because I don't get the chance to talk about the Teochew. My aunts married a Teochew guy from Singapore. You know, my sister-in-law is Teochew. So we have lots of family that are Teochew in our bigger family. So,
what's your heritage, Leo?
I'm Malaysian Chinese, but both my grandfathers are from a Minnan speaker. They're from Fujian.
Hokkien or?
And Hokkien, which we'll call Hokkien, but My mom's side came from, again, a Minnanese-speaking region in Guangdong province.
Okay, close by.
Very near Chaozhou, very near Chaozhou, yeah. So, see, it's the fun thing is we have so many speakers that migrate to other regions and start mixing things up. Like my grandmother is Hakka. So that's a my family is very mixed in the in that sense. Yeah, these are very distinct regional people in southern China that historically don't talk to each other or fight each other. They will actually fight each other, and you know, they dislike each other. But when they came to Malaysia and Singapore, they had to mix as neighbors. And that started the kind of the melting pot. And each one of these actually tradition, I would say, clan actually keep to their own culinary and sometimes medicinal traditions as well. Right? For example, the Teochew people are famous for their congee. I don't know if you know that, Cara, right? Congee, they are the congee eating people. The Teochew are very famous for, you know, cooking a pot of congee and then eating these little dishes with the congee.
I didn't
Whereas you, yeah. So that's what my mom taught me. It's like the Teochew people, you know, they eat olives. That's the only olive eating people in southern China.
Really?
Olive, pickled olive is one of the major dishes of a Teochew people. I think it's because they were connected to global trade and things like that. They're from a very early on, and they adopted certain. Teochew are famous for their yangsheng as well.
Yeah, my mum, whenever I was sick, she'd always, this is the hybridization, right? We call it jok, right? Is congee and, and Teochew, I guess.
Yeah.
And she would make it very, very plain, and then she'd put a dollop of Marmite in it. You know, Marmite is what they eat in Australia and New Zealand. I would hate it. I'd get so angry. I was like, oh, yuck, yuck. Anyway, global job.
Anything else that you can remember about?
Well, I wanted to say I heard about my great-grandfather from my aunt recently when I was in Singapore, and she's one of the older aunts because my mum's family has maybe 12-plus children. And so my grandmother, her father was the Chinese doctor, and my aunt said, oh, he was very famous for a particular herbal medicine. He would be really good at treating a kind of heat disease. I think it's from the tropics. Excessive heat and inflammation, basically. I have to look up the name. She told me the name, but very specialist kind of treatment. Anyway, so I thought that was very interesting. But other than, you know, growing up, I can't really say that we would sit around the table and talk about yangsheng or anything. You know, it's just like, don't drink warm water, you know, eat good food. It's pretty simple, right? But it's in your bones. You know what is good and what's not good for your body somehow.
But that's what we're interested in. See, that's exactly what we're interested in, Kara. I think you're saying it's in your bones. And you're like, oh, we didn't really do anything. But
yeah, I don't know. It wasn't like, let's all go out and do Tai Chi and drink herbal medicine together. I don't know. You know?
I think that's what's interesting about the conversations that we're having is sometimes when things are so close to our upbringing and culture that we took it for granted and not realizing that in other families or in other countries, that is unheard of.
Yes.
So where did that come from? We never heard of that. So like, for example, this warm water thing, that's something that is not common at all outside of the sinosphere. Or even I have heard that in Korea and in Japan, they don't follow that either. It's specifically in the Chinese region that we have this. So it's so interesting that we have similar family story, that my grand uncle was also a physician from southern China. And it's also interesting that a lot of times in Chinese families, they don't talk about things.
No.
Right? We don't talk about history. It took a long time for us to figure out, like for me to figure out, oh, actually, I had two maternal grandmothers. And the one that I called grandma wasn't our biological grandma. But because the grandma number one passed away when my mom and her two sisters were very young, they never wanted to talk about it. Because my mom wanted us to think that second grandma is our only grandma. Doesn't matter.
Same in my family.
Right. So
my mom has two mums. Right. Same. The family was too big so that the later children, they couldn't afford to look after all the children. So the later children went to my grandparents' brother and his wife, and they raised the last four girls, right? And one of them, my mum. So that is a very interesting thing about a kind of a break in the kind of, I felt that in my own body, a kind of a breaking of that link with the maternal. The link is there physiologically, right? But it was like my mum had to start calling from when she was maybe six, she moved to the new house. She had to now, you know, not let the new family, you want to respect the new family, right? So now this is her mother and this is her father. And even at my grandfather's funeral, at first she was given the little patch on the shoulder, like you get a little color patch and it shows where you are in the family. So at first she was given the patch of probably, what would that be, niece? But she was very, very upset. And I'd never seen her express that emotion before in the family. It was never talked about, right? A lot of these things, as far as I know. I mean, I'm a kid. What do I know, right? Maybe these adults talk about all these things. I don't know. But from my point of view, they didn't. And then, and I could see my grandmother seeing my mother's distress, my maternal biological grandmother. And so they did this thing where they made a hybrid patch of two colors. Oh, yes, you are my daughter and you're also my niece, kind of thing. That was how I interpreted it. I was there, maybe I was 15 years old. That's what I saw and how healing that was. Wow. Because, yes, she was still in our life, our real grandmother, but she was my grandmother, yet I also had this other grandmother. And so I had to kind of not treat my real grandmother too much like my grandmother, you know what I mean? But then she still was my grandmother. It was a very, yeah, anyway. So it's very healing to realize, no, biologically, physiologically, there is this connection. Like I look at my hand, my thumb, and that is my mother's thumb and that is my grandmother's thumb. I see them when they eat. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm the body of my, I'm their body continuing through time and space, right? Anyway, that triggered what you just said there, Leo. Yeah, the Chinese families, I think, don't talk a lot about the history and the, yeah. Maybe certain family members do. I think in my family, certain family members are really into it, and one of my cousins is very good at asking questions and sharing things.
And it's so different in the U.S. where people, and maybe I'm a little jaded right now because right now my daughter's not talking to me, and I feel like that's a huge cultural difference that German kids would never just do that, but.
Mm.
This is America, and my daughter is American. And in America, it's all about growing up and being independent and finding yourself. Individualization is so important. And I do feel like there's this huge cultural rupture, which is one of the reasons why I've always felt more comfortable in Hispanic culture. Because there's a very different, and also in Chinese culture, there's a very different relationship with the extended family. It's not just a nuclear family. And I don't know how much of that is cultural and how much of it is generational. Yeah, because our families are so much smaller now. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought family size is also an interesting factor as well, because Kara just mentioned earlier that how many children or relatives? You have a huge family, right? Extended.
Yeah, my mum's family, My grandmother had at least 12 children.
Yeah. So same here with my maternal side, you know. She has about like 15 siblings.
Mm.
Yeah, and then again, I don't know about, is this their family or just, you know, there's like one that passed away when she was really young and they never want to talk about her. Mm. Oh, not really young, but, you know, she married and had a kid. So we never knew that cousin. She never showed up at New Year's. Mm. You know, so, and then, you know, it took a long time for us to figure out, oh, there are two grandmothers and all of these younger aunties are really just the half aunties, you know? And it's the funniest thing is it took actually I went to college and my college friend told me that I had two grandmothers because my cousin was telling her, or told her, apparently my auntie told her the children, but my mom never talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go to college and learn it from my college friends.
Mm-hmm. So
that I had
both of you. Did you, or like in particular, Cara, did you grow up in New Zealand? Was your mom the only one in your family who moved to New Zealand, or did you grow up with your extended family?
No. So my father is a Pākehā, a white European Irish New Zealander, and had joined the New Zealand Army and went to Singapore for training in the early 80s and met my mum. And then it was time to leave and they said, okay, let's get married. And she came back to New Zealand, right?
So on her own?
On her own.
With her new husband.
So it was very, very coming into 1980s New Zealand, very white, and at least where we lived. And I think quite a big shock, I think, for my mother, and probably a big shock for my dad's family. I'm just guessing. Although two more of my dad's brothers also married Singaporean or Malaysian Chinese women, which is very interesting. So we have six Eurasian grandchildren in my family now. So, but yeah, I grew up I really was brought up by, you know, my white side of my family when I was in New Zealand. Mm. You know, my white grandmother and uncles. And only when I was very lucky to have lived in Singapore in my 6, 7, 8 years old, where I got a lot of that early kind of conditioning, I guess, and went to school in Singapore and so learned Chinese and things like that. I think if I hadn't done that, I would have very, very little connection. Yeah.
And what about you, Leo? Like, you grew up in Malaysia in your extended family, and then you went to the U.S. on your own?
Yeah. But I grew up very Chinese.
Yeah.
That's the, very Chinese because the whole family is Chinese. And
yeah.
So we had a lot of that.
So for you, it was that break away.
It was your choice.
You were an adult.
Leaving. Yeah,
mm.
Exactly.
Mm.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I didn't go into Chinese medicine first, right? I went into computer science.
Mm. Very practical. Yeah, so, much smarter.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. But Chinese medicine is sort of my second career and kind of a going back to that. It's very interesting to see the contrast between Cara and I, you know. It's like, both of us have a return to the Chinese culture, the language, you know. I don't know if I can't speak for Cara, but for me it was a rediscovery again, sort of a rediscovery, a deepening of that identity and that heritage.
Mm-hmm. And I think...
And realizing, that, you know, a lot of the things that my mom passed on to me were really valuable, but I just didn't know, and she didn't know.
Yeah.
And I think that's we're interested in. That's kind of what started this whole conversation, that I feel like there are a lot of Chinese medicine practitioners in the West who are Asian American, and I'm interested in why do these people choose to go into Chinese medicine? And a lot of times it's not even conscious. Or a lot of the students that I've had at the National University of Medicine, or even now in my classical Chinese programs, why do they, it's a way of choosing to reconnect with your heritage. And mm-hmm. sometimes it's not even, I mean, it sounds like for you, Cara, it was somewhat conscious. That you were clear that these are your roots, and practicing the medicine, learning about the medicine is part of exploring an aspect of your.
Yeah, there's definitely a drive there. Yeah, I mean, what I'm thinking is this is really a story of immigration, you know, like what happens when cultures immigrate. So like Leo's family, you know, immigrated to Malaysia, right? Mine to Singapore. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of practitioners in North America or Europe, it's the same, like Asians moving to North America and what happens, right? And so we have to go then to the institutions in a way to learn what our culture is, perhaps. Or mainland China. For me, I went to mainland China on a exchange scholarship. And then
the first generation of immigrants, like in my experience, I'm a first generation immigrant to the mm-hmm. U.S. And so are you, Leo. You're a little bit different from me, but I rejected everything German when I left Germany when I was 18, and I moved first to Taiwan and then to America. And I did not want to speak German. I left all that and I just wanted to fit in, and I could see how maybe
like I want to say something about that. Like, I think that what I was saying, like intellectually, there is like a great like draw to the Asian traditions and the great, you know, great learning and the great culture and medicine and everything. And then what I realized is there was this kind of rift in my being. There was also a kind of basically internalized racism, right? And I'm going to give a personal story here. And so, for example, dating. You might not think about this, right? Or maybe we do now, right? I was like, okay, I'm going to go on a date, right? It was winter in Canada. It was spring in Canada. And then I noticed, oh my God, I am like swiping left on the Asians and right on the white people.
Which means what? I'm sorry.
Well, I might have got it back to front myself, but basically I'm favoring white. I'm favoring white, right? Ethnically to date. And I was I caught myself because I had this conversation going with this Asian woman. And I was kind of like really slow to respond to her and kind of ignoring her in a way. And then I was kind of really writing back really quickly to the white people I was messaging, right? And then I caught myself. Luckily, I'm a meditator, right? Trained to observe the mind. But even then, Jesus, took me a while. Excuse me. But I realized, my God, no, I'm basically favoring Europeanness. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to go on a date with this Asian woman. I'm just going to do it, right? Because I've got something here I need to look at, right? So I went on this date with her. And I had this view that she was going to be really backward or something, right? And I met her, and she's Canadian Chinese, right? Brought up in Ontario by Hong Kong Southern Chinese immigrants who moved also to Canada. So she was born there. And anyway, we had a great time. It was great. You know, she had hot water and gave me goji berries on our first date, right? Anyway, and I had my hot water there too. You know, it was quite funny. Anyway, that was a whole lot of learning, because at one point I said to her, I was like, I have to admit something to you. You know, I didn't really want to go meet you, you know, because you're Chinese and I've never dated an Asian, really, you know. And she said, oh, don't worry, me neither, right? She'd never dated an Asian. She'd only dated white men or white women, right? Right. They're kind of like really, yeah. And we were just like, oh my goodness, right? We really have this. We both wanted to be as white as possible. You want to fit in with the dominant culture, right? So I think that internalized racism shows up a lot, right? And for immigrants, like you were saying, German. I don't know about for you, Leo, but that was a real example to me. And then I started to notice, as a Eurasian, a mixed race person, we can kind of slide into the white category perhaps more easily. So when I say went on a date with her and we were sitting outside on the courtyard in downtown, small town BC, right, Canada, very white town, and we were sitting having sushi, and then I realized I felt afraid. I felt scared sitting there on the sidewalk. And I was like, what is going on? Why am I afraid, right? Because normally I'm out with my white friends. So I look like part of the white group, right? But now I'm sitting with her. She looks very Chinese. Okay, I'm here. Now I look like an Asian woman, right? With another Asian woman. Oh, now all the thoughts about what Asian women should be or who they are and their place in society and how we should be showing up and what people think of us all came pouring through. And I don't know. I don't know where it came from. I just felt like people were going to yell at us or, you know, send out racist slurs as we were sitting there. I mean, that's never happened in my life. I've never seen it. I've seen it passively, maybe passive-aggressive racism, say, towards Asian people and white cultures. But that was never would have actually happened. But I could see it, right, in my body, the kind of ways, I guess, why I tried to negate the Chinese side in my being. Anyway, I don't know if that leads anyone anywhere. Yeah.
Well, I think that's significant, because a lot of these emotions and biases does have an effect on the human body.
Mm.
Right. And also I think depending on, for example, the patient population that we treat that we see as practitioners, and they do differ from one group of people to the other.
Mm.
Certain groups of people or ethnicities or certain class or groups of people, however you want to divide them, when they have received systemic racism or some kind of discrimination, it does sometimes live in the bodies.
Mm.
So something that to be I don't know if that's your Kara, you have witnessed that in yourself in terms of the bias and the fear. It seems I heard fear there. I wonder if you have observed similar patterns in your patient population, for example.
Yeah, really good question.
Just a curiosity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say the indigenous patients, indigenous people that I've treated, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Quite distinctly.
How does that show up?
Yeah, I think I have a more of a sense of I need to be very careful before coming into their space. Like there's very much been a breach of their boundary, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And almost like I need to ask permission in a kind of energetic way or something. It's like there's a hurt there and you kind of can't just kind of go right in and treat. There's something I have to be very respectful about.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, but yeah, anyway, that's just what comes up for me there when you ask that question.
That brought up another question, sort of growing up, how was your interaction with like the natives of New Zealand? How was that?
Yeah, that was well, you know, it's been so great being back here now. Like, so I'm 40, I'm 41 actually, I just turned 41. And New Zealand it feels very different now than 20, 30 years ago. Like, I'm very proud of what New Zealand has done in a way, Aotearoa New Zealand. Like, there is Māori, te reo Māori is being spoken all over the place now, right? It's almost like a second language within the functioning of the government. Wow. And I was just at a conference, things like that. It's just being used. And that wasn't the case when I was growing up. And I remember racist moments when I was a child. Like, I remember walking into my classroom, my new school, and there was a Māori boy. And I remember thinking, oh, he's a Māori boy. He's not as good as, you know, the other people, right? And I think also I've heard this phenomena, right? Immigrants or people of the different minorities will mm-hmm. also vie for position versus support each other, you know? So what do they call the mm-hmm. that Asians tend to be model minorities in North America? So kind of get the mm-hmm. perks of being the best behaved minority or something, you know what I mean? But certainly not support the African Americans plight, or, you know, like, we'll try to be as close to the white people as possible. So I could see that happening in myself, right? Oh, I felt very ashamed to be part Chinese. I don't want people to know my mum's this foreigner. And therefore, oh, look at that dumb Maori boy, right? Like, that came up in me. I was probably 8 years old. You know, these things are there. Where do we learn that, right? Anyway, but now... And I think as a society, that was very much the way it was in New Zealand, right? And it's changing and it's changing and it's changing and evolving and growing. And I really feel very, very glad for that. There's a great pride in the Pacific kind of heritage, the Pacific peoples of New Zealand now.
Yeah, so I feel like we're kind of getting at the end of our time. So I think we should try and do the continuation and go into women's health. Mm. But I have one last question, maybe to wrap this up, about general. In general, do you think your heritage, your Asian Chinese heritage has influenced your, or how has it, if at all, influenced your Chinese, your practice, your clinical practice as a Chinese medicine practitioner? I think that's my question with all of these interviews, you know, is there something in the Asian women as healthcare providers experience? And we can explore this in the next section on women's health, if that's appropriate, but is there something about your general practice does that question make sense, Leo, at all? Like, do you see where I'm going with
it? Of course.
This? Or is this just like even a crazy thought? It's just, to me, this whole series that we're doing, we're interviewing these women, and I'm trying to figure out if there is a unifying thread, if there's anything that they're bringing to the voice of Asian medicine being practiced in the West that makes it special, or what is, do you see where I'm going with this, Cara or Leo?
Yeah.
It's just a question. I have no idea if there's an answer.
Or if Cara needs some time to think about it, we can maybe use that as the beginning of our second session. Sort of.
Yeah.
Well,
as a suggestion.
Well, I'm curious what Leo has to say, but I think what comes to mind to me first is that I really appreciate that you're asking these questions and interviewing Asian women in the medicine, because I feel like the dominant voices, I've been noticing this, and I might just be what I'm listening to or reading or something, but the dominant voices are very North American, European, male, nothing against, you know, that demographic, like, fantastic work that people are doing, but it is a very underrepresented voice. And maybe there's history there, right? In Chinese medicine, women doctors' voices were not really shared, probably, in the history. I don't know. You could tell us more about that, Sabina, in classical writings.
But okay, that's a great point to take mm-hmm. up. I would push back against that. It's just what the environment is, because the people who were practicing midwifery, who were talking about menstruation, were the women. Yeah. And
I would save that for our second.
Yeah, that's a whole other can of worms.
Great place to start.
Are we in our second session now, or are we just finishing the first one?
No, you are wrapping up the first one. We're waiting for your final. If there's any, if you want to just conclude your thought.
I think, you know, Sabina, we met at the, what was the retreat called? The Power of Yin. The Extraordinary Power of Yin.
Transformative Power of Yin.
The Transformative Power of Yin was Lillian Bridges and you and Brenda Hood teaching that with a lovely group of women. And I'd say, you know...
And the two of them insisted that we use the word power. And I remember I really was uncomfortable with that at first.
Right.
And Brenda and Lillian were like, no, this is the power of yin.
Yeah. So
and now that I'm menopausal, it's like, yeah. I can relate a lot better than I did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Or whenever it was 5 years ago.
Yeah. So there's something about that theme that makes that kind of comes to mind when we talk about women practitioners. I don't really know about Asian practitioners particularly. I can't say what might be the difference, but I think it has something to do with that yin quality. The kind of silence. I don't feel particularly intellectual in my practice. And I'm kind of often impressed by all the intellectual discussions that go on in the Chinese medicine field, and I think we need it. But I feel very much there is that silent, we're getting to work day after day in the clinic and being with people and trying to help. And I don't know if you can really put that into words, you know. And I think that's what people have done for generations. And perhaps that's what the Asian culture brings, that heritage brings. It's just like, hey, it's not such a big deal, guys. Just do what you can. Do your bit. Don't make it into too big a thing. We're all people helping people, doing the best we can. You know, something like that. I feel like my great-grandfather would have just treated like that. Yeah, I'm just doing the best I can here. Give me a few dollars here. Here's the herbs. You know, kind of like just live your life. You know, there's that kind of relaxation around health. It's like, yeah, I can see Leo nodding. I'm not sure if what he's thinking, but yeah.
I think that's perfect. I think that's spot on. And that's exactly why we're doing what we're doing. Okay, thank you.
Very cool. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of our podcast, Pebble in the Cosmic Pond. As a new experiment in our season 2 on Over the Moon, because we so love these conversations, we have decided to release new episodes not only on the new moon, but from here on out on a bi-weekly schedule. So on the new and on the full moon. We'll see if we can keep it going. The full moon episodes used to just be for the members of my Imperial Tutor Mentorship, but we all feel like this information is too precious to not share it with the general public. If you enjoyed this conversation, remember to subscribe to my newsletter at happygoatproductions.com/connect to get notified of future episodes and other offerings. And if you want access to the more specialized and truly nerdy conversations that Leo and I are having in the Imperial Tutorial, please take a look at my Imperial Tutor Mentorship, which you can find at my website at happygoatproductions.com/imperialtutor. Also, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and share our work with your friends and colleagues. And if you feel like it, continue the conversation for each episode on our Pebble in a Cosmic Pond Facebook group. Last, but definitely not least, go out there and spread some positive vibrations between heaven and earth. Goodbye.